This is Evangelist Ted Weiland. This tape contains an interview with archaeologist Raymond Capp. The interview was conducted by myself on Scriptures for America's shortwave radio program. It contains information which I thought those on the tape ministry would find both interesting and valuable. Scriptures for America's shortwave radio program can be heard on WHRI, World Harvest Radio International, Monday through Friday at 8 to 9 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, and Sunday, 9:30 to 11 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on dial setting 7315 shortwave. Greetings to the lost sheep of the House of Israel. Welcome to Scriptures for America, being broadcast on WHRI, World Harvest Radio International. This is Evangelist Ted Weiland filling in for Pastor Pete Peters tonight. We are broadcasting from Kalispell, Montana at Scriptures for America's 1993 Rocky Mountain Family Bible Camp. This is the ninth annual camp that Scriptures for America has hosted. The previous ones have been held in Colorado, but because of Scriptures for America's and Pastor Pete Peters, and some of the rest of our reputations, they have not seen fit to keep us in Colorado this year, so we've had to move it up to Montana. We're excited about this camp. We're only hardly a day into camp, and we've already had some great preaching, some exciting preaching. Tonight we heard a fiery message from Lewis Beam. Some of you will recognize that name. I believe Pastor Peters has had him on at least a couple times on some of his previous programs. And I'm sure that you found him very interesting. As a matter of fact, his tape and the rest of the tapes from the rest of the speakers at this week-long camp will be available through Scriptures for America. You can get those tapes or those messages simply by writing Scriptures for America at P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. I might also at this time give the fax number that Pastor Peters usually gives out. For those of you who may have something that you want to fax to Pastor Peters, as I mentioned in the last half an hour, he often uses those faxes either in a message or possibly in a shortwave radio program. If you have something of importance that you need to fax to Pastor Peters, he has a dedicated line. That number is 307-745-5914. That's 307-745-5914. I might also just share with you, as I did in the last half an hour, some of the speakers that will be coming up in this camp. Just for example, for tomorrow, we're going to have Pastor Earl Jones along with Pastor Peters about the same time. Matter of fact, classes, there's usually a multiple choice of preachers and teachers to be able to listen to at the same time. It's kind of almost a three-ring circus up here at times. It's an exciting camp. Pastor Earl Jones, I believe that Pastor Peters has also had him a time or two on the program. He'll be speaking. Pastor Peters will be bringing his third message of the camp already. Also, an elder in Israel, Roger Stevens, will be bringing a message entitled More Than the Blood of Christ. We also have Doug Evers. Here's an interesting title for you. It's called Fats and More Fats. I think he, too, has been a previous guest on the shortwave program. And he'll be bringing, I'm sure, an interesting message. Also, for the young girls and mothers tomorrow morning, Sherry Peters is bringing a message entitled Virtue in the Mirror. This is one only for the women, one that the men can't attend, but one that I'm sure will be a blessing to all the women who attend. Richard Hoskins, great historian and economist, bringing a message entitled 21st Century Warfare. I'm sharing all of this with you, and that's, by the way, just what we're going to have in the morning, along with young people's classes and a lot of other things as well. I just share that with you, just to whet your appetite for the next camp that's coming up. You may not have been able to attend this camp or any of the previous camps. Let me tell you, if you haven't attended a Scriptures for America camp, you have missed out on a great time of spiritual revival, a great time of relaxation, good times, fun times, times to really be rejuvenated spiritually. Some of the greatest preaching. I've been involved in other kinds of camps in the past, and I can say I've never been involved with the quality and the depth and the deep preaching that's usually available at one of Scriptures for America's camps. And I'm just sharing this again with you to whet your appetite for the next camp coming up. It's going to be this fall, September 3rd through the 6th at Falling Waters, West Virginia. We've got people here at this camp coming as far away as Wisconsin and Missouri and Louisiana and from all over the United States. Oftentimes we almost have all 50 states represented in our camps. So if they can come as far as back east and you're out west, don't think it's too far not to go to Falling Waters, West Virginia on September 3rd through the 6th and attend the camp. I'll guarantee if you go, if you make the trip, you will not be disappointed. If you want information on Falling Waters, West Virginia, that will be available sometime in the near future by writing Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. Might mention, too, if you haven't ever received a newsletter, you may be hearing this program for the first time tonight. And Scriptures for America may be brand new to you. Well, a good way to get introduced to Scriptures for America's ministries, pastored by Pastor Pete Peters, you might want to write or call. You can call in or write the address I just gave you and ask for a free newsletter. They put out throughout the year a newsletter called Scriptures for America Newsletter. And I'll guarantee that you'll find some things in that newsletter that you'll find nowhere else across this country. And again, I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you're listening to this program tonight, order one of those. If you haven't received a newsletter in the past, get on your telephone later on or get down and write down the address and send for a free Scriptures for America newsletter. In there you'll also find that there's a tape ministry, national tape ministry, and international tape ministry that's available of messages primarily from Pastor Peters and his pulpit in Colorado, but also from many times from several other men who either have spoken at his church in Colorado or sometimes messages from these camps. And again, that's all available by writing Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. And write, get that newsletter. I'll guarantee you either the past one or the one to come out in the future, you will be pleased with it, and it will open your eyes to things you've possibly never seen before. Well, I think you'll be excited with what we're going to be doing tonight. We have a special guest right here in Kalispell, Montana with us, one of the speakers at this camp. We have here in this office, we've borrowed an office from a local church where we've got our equipment set up. We have with us today E. Raymond Capp, biblical archaeologist and historian. Mr. Capp has done extensive research in the Middle East and Europe, and he is noted probably most for his identification of certain cuneiform tablets from Nineveh, now in the British Museum, as relating directly to the so-called lost tribes of Israel. And at this point, I want to share a scripture with you. It's found in Hebrews chapter 8 and verses, let's see here, we'll read verses 8 and 9. It says, "For finding fault with them," speaking of the Israelites of old, he says, "Behold, days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, for they did not continue in my covenant, and I did not care for them, says Yahweh." You know, in past times for myself, and I don't know how many times I've heard it since, so often people want to try to take this passage and spiritualize it, and say that the new covenant here was made with the church, or with those people being saved. I want you to note a couple of the things that are stated in this verse, in these two verses. It says first that it's the new covenant that we're speaking about, that that new covenant is going to be made with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. I want to challenge anybody out there who may be listening to this program who may think that that identifies a spiritual group of people. I want to challenge you to come up with a verse in the Bible that ever identifies those people termed the house of Israel and the house of Judah as being spiritual people. And if we don't find precedent for that being spiritualized somewhere before this passage in the Bible, then the only way we can spiritualize it in this passage is if the passage itself spiritualizes it, or the writer of the book of Hebrews. But you'll see here that there is absolutely no way. First of all, there is nowhere in the Bible that those two terms are ever spiritualized. But there is absolutely, in this case, even if there was, in this particular case, there is no way to spiritualize these terms. I want you to note what it says. It says not like the covenant. It says that the covenant is made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Then it says, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers. Now, if the house of Israel and the house of Judah in this passage are a spiritual group of people, then the fathers that are being spoken of here must be spiritual too. But know what it says. It says, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and I did not care for them, says Yahweh. Isn't that interesting? There is preachers across this land today, like myself in the past, who want to try to spiritualize this passage to say that it's speaking of someone, a spiritual group of people, a people of all races who have come to our Lord and Savior. But indeed, if you read the passage for what it says, there is absolutely no way to spiritualize it. Now note in this passage that a particular group of people are identified as being who the new covenant is being made with. Usually it's good, if we can, to provide a second witness for those things that we find in the Bible. And we find a second witness for this passage in Romans chapter 9 and verses 3 and 4. It says, and notice again, there's absolutely no way that these two verses can be spiritualized either. Verse 3, it says, "For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from the Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons, and the glory, and the covenants, and the giving of the law, and the service, and the promises." I'm reading from the New American Standard Version. Note here again, it says that the covenants belong to Israel. What covenants? Well, all the covenants do. We know that the Abrahamic covenant belonged to Abraham, and it says, and to his descendants. We know, of course, that the Mosaic covenant was specifically given to the Israelites. And according to Hebrews 8 and verse 8, we also know that the new covenant was not given to everyone across this land, but it was specifically given to those people known as the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Now, I want to bring those two passages out to you, because I think if we can see that the new covenant was made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, it would probably be important, maybe even imperative, that we identify who those people are today. Of course, many people today think that those people are the Jews. You ask the average citizen or Christian out there, and you ask them who is Israel today, and of course they're going to tell you that the Jews, the people called Jews today, are Israel. And isn't that interesting? That's what the preachers today have taught our people, when in fact the Jews themselves have admitted that they are not Israel. For example, I have before me a copy of the Jewish Almanac, the 1980 Jewish Almanac. The first chapter is entitled Identity Crisis, with a subheading entitled A Brief History of the Terms for Jew. And it says in the very first sentence, I quote, "Strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew." Did you hear that? Listen again. It says, quote, "Strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew," end quote. Now there, that's not Pastor Ted Weiland or Pastor Pete Peters telling you that the Jews are not Israel. That is the Jews themselves. And by the way, they admit it over and over and over again. Not necessarily for goyim ears, as they would say it. Many times they wrote it only for themselves. But there are a few honest souls out there amongst the Jews who are openly admitting it. For example, there was a man by the name of Arthur Kessler, in a book titled The 13th Tribe, where he documents completely that the Jews today cannot trace their lineage back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but instead are descendants from the Khazar tribes from the steppes of Russia. Now, I don't want to keep going on, but I wanted to bring that out because I, again, think it's imperative that we identify correctly who Israel is today. After all, the new covenant was made with Israel. And the Jews admit that they are not Israel, so if they're not, someone indeed today must be. Again, we have with us E. Raymond Capt. He is most noted for his identification of certain cuneiform tablets from Nineveh. Now, the Bible and history does confirm that the majority of the Israelite nations were carried into Assyrian captivity. Read from 2 Kings 17 and verse 6, and let me just read it to you. It says, "In the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Hala and in Habor by the river Gozan in the city of the Medes." Everyone agrees with that, historians and archaeologists alike. But overlooked by Bible scholars is what Hosea, who prophesied regarding the captivity of Israel, added in Hosea 1 and verse 10, concerning Israel as being brought back into, I quote, "the bond of the covenant." Sounds like they were to be recovenanted somewhere. I think you'd probably have to agree. Now, Mr. Capt has the answer to the fate of the Israelites, so I'm going to ask him questions so that you may have answers from an archaeological viewpoint. First, however, let me provide you Mr. Capt's credentials. He holds a Master of Arts degree in Christian History and Biblical Archaeology from Covenant College, Lake Wales, Florida. He is a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries of Scotland. He is also a member of the Archaeological Institute of America and holds California State teaching credentials in Biblical Archaeology and History. He also holds an honorary Doctorate of Literature from the Academy of Bible of Science in Italy, a school established in 450 A.D. Now, let me go to my questions for Mr. Capt. Mr. Capt, how long ago? First of all, we're glad to have you here on the program.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. Mr. Capt, how long ago were the tablets found that you identify as dealing with Israel?
They were actually found in 1850 by the University of Pennsylvania when they were excavating the ruins at Nineveh. Now, that was a time when no one could read the cuneiform language on the tablets. It was not till about 1930 that they were translated and published by Professor Waterman of the University of Michigan.
Now, you mean for over 60 years after they were translated, the Bible scholars have known what happened to the Israelites and haven't made it known?
Well, not exactly. They knew about the tablets, but did not connect them with the Israelites. The reason they didn't was because they were mixed up among some 20,000 tablets that were found. Now, these were separated, and all the tablets that had royal names like Sargon, Sennacherib, or Ashurbanipal, they were laid to one side, and they call that the Royal Correspondence of the Assyrian Empire. Ended up at about 1,700 of those tablets. Now, when they were translated, they were still not understood for the simple reason the Assyrians called the Israelites by other names. They did not recognize Israel on those tablets at that time, what I'm trying to say.
Now, obviously, some of the archaeologists out there have not made the connection. How were you able to make that connection?
Well, the information on the tablets described the activities of a people living in the Israelites had been placed only a few years earlier. Other clues were describing them as being, quote, now, strangers to the land, unquote, and having the worship of only one god.
What were some of the other names the Assyrians called the Israelites?
Well, one name was Gemeria or Gemera. Now, the land they lived in was called Gemir. Perhaps I should explain about the status of these Israelites. They were never slaves in the sense of the word. They were taken from their homeland to be settled around the borders of Assyria to really act as buffer defense against any foreign invasions. In other words, the Israelites would have to fight for their lives, which would slow up any enemy forces coming against Assyria.
Now, that makes sense, but did that ever happen? I mean,
yes. That was the substance of one of the first tablets that I published. It was dated around 707 B.C., and was a report from an Assyrian spy on the fighting between now the Gemara and the forces from Urartu. This is a report sent to King Sargon. In another tablet, Sennacherib, the son of Sargon, sent a report to his father that the Gemara had won a major battle. He even mentions they invaded the land and killed 10 commanders. Now the Urartuans, they gained a major battle, which eliminated the Urartuans as a major threat to Assyria.
Now, in your book, Mr. Capt, your book, The Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets, you state that the Assyrian tablets prove that the Israelites did not amalgamate with the people of the area where they were exiled. And, of course, that's what many preachers across this land are telling us, that the tribes amalgamated and just basically disappeared. But you say something different than that.
Well, yes. The tablets definitely prove that the Israelites were not assimilated with the inhabitants of the places they were placed by the Assyrians, but actually escaped and migrated out of the land where they had been held captive.
Now, let me go back to your book, The Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets. Let me mention to those of you who are listening to the program, if you want a real eye-opener, let me suggest that you write Mr. Capt and order his book, The Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets. It is a real eye-opener. It'll open up things to you concerning archaeology, but also it will open up the Bible to new truths that you can't believe until you begin to see them. Ray, why don't you give your address at this time and the price for your book?
It's Artisan Sales, P.O. Box 1497, Thousand Oaks, California, 91358. And the book is $11 postpaid, over 256 pages.
Okay, let me say, it's well worth, what was it, $11, Ray?
$11.
$11. Let me tell you, it is well worth $11 and more. The material that's found in that book, how many pages is it, Ray?
256 pages. About 100 charts and illustrations and maps.
Okay, 256 pages of material that you'll get nowhere else.
And photographs of those tablets that never had been published before. They're in the British Museum today.
Okay, if you thought maybe this archaeologist is making up what he's sharing with you here at this time, he's actually got the pictures of the cuneiform tablets in his book. And again, it's got more information in it that certainly is worth more than what he's asking for it. Now, you mentioned, Ray, that that the Israelites were not assimilated and that they were placed by the Assyrians in different places, and they escaped and migrated out of the land where they had been held captive. Did they escape individually or in groups or at one time? Well, how did that go?
They mostly escaped in groups, and not all at the one time, but over a period of some years, and mostly after the Assyrians fell to the Medes and the Persians.
Now, something we might add in here, too, that probably most people don't recognize, the Bible, most people think that the Assyrian captivity only regarded the house of Israel. It's true that it also took a big portion of the house of Judah as well. Is that not true?
That's true. About 48 fenced cities of Judah were carried to Assyrian captivity. Only the city of Jerusalem, those inhabitants, were carried to Babylon, a point that many Bible scholars overlook.
Okay, so in other words, it wasn't just the 10 tribes who was taken into Assyrian captivity, but really the biggest part of all 12 tribes.
That's right.
Okay. All right, do we have any idea how the Israelites got the name Gemira?
Well, Gemira, or Gemirai, is sometimes spelled Gemira, is most likely derived from an corruption of Gomri or Qumri. Now, these are names the Assyrians called the Israelites even 50 years before the captivity. The name Qumri is found on the Black Obelisk in the British Museum. Now, this was made by Shalmaneser III. It's an inscription recording the Israelite king Jehu bringing tribute to the Assyrian king. The inscription reads, "This is Yahweh, or Jehu, the son of Qumri," meaning Omri, who was one of the last kings of northern Israel before the captivity. Now, Omri is pronounced in Hebrew with a guttural H like G or K. And the Assyrians pronounced Omri as Gomri, which they wrote Qumri.
Now, you say the tablets reported the escape of the Israelites. Do the tablets say where they went?
Yes. The first group to escape, were called Gemirai, escaped northwest to the shores of the Black Sea. Now, this was during the second year of the reign of Esarhaddon, the Assyrian king, about 679 B.C. After they escaped, they raided Lydia and settled there for a while. And later they moved around the Black Sea into the Carpathian regions. We find that called in the Bible, in 2 Esdras, Arsareth, or Mountains of Sareth.
Do we have any independent confirmation of this outside of the tablets?
Yes. The Greeks reported the same movements of these Gemira. They reported the invasion of Lydia, and they also mentioned that the Gemirai was later pushed out of the area. Now, interestingly enough, the Greeks use a different name for the Israelites. They call the Gemira Kimeroi in their records.
Sounds almost like there's some similarity there. You see the tie-in, I think. Well, that's a new name, Kimeroi, is that right?
Kimeroi.
You know, no. I've never heard of that particular name before I read read your book. I believe you say it in English. Its translation is Kimerian?
Cimmerian, yes, Cimmerian. Some say Cimmerian, but it's Cimmerian. Now, that is the name, the early, that was actually the early name for the Celts, that later on became the bedrock of the British race as they migrated west.
I believe you state that some settled in France and Spain as well, but what about the Gimmerai that did not escape with that first group of people?
Well, those that didn't escape, they later accepted an alliance with Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, when he came under attack now by both the Medes and the Persians. Now, this new alliance allowed the Israelites to have complete freedom to establish colonies in Sacrocene in the north and Bactria in the east.
Did those colonies remain, and do their descendants live there today?
No, none there today. After Assyria fell, and by the way, with no help from the Israelites, the Medes and the Persians later tried to conquer the Israelites. They were still at that time now called Gimmerai. Now, these two colonies, they finally were pushed out. Those living in Sacrocene moved north through the Darial Pass in the Caucasus and occupied the steppe regions of South Russia. Now, the Greeks, interestingly, called the Gimmerai Scythians. Now, those that had settled east of Bactria, they migrated north around the Caspian Sea, and some actually went east. Now, while most of these Israelites there retained the name Scythian, or Scythian, you might say, it's really Scythian, some reports said they used the name Massagetae, which means the great Saka horde. Others were called Ishkuzi. Now, that is a name that can be shown derived from Isaac. Now, those that went east were called Sakai or Saka.
Now, do we have any independent confirmation of these names, any historical or further archaeological evidence?
Okay, both if we consider inscriptions as historical. I do. We have the famous Behistun rock. That's a trilingual inscription found in Persia. It carries the annals or records of Darius I, who reigned between 522 and about 485 B.C. In the inscriptions, every time the word Gimmerai or Gemira appears in the Babylonian version, the Persians and the Edomite versions use the name Saka or Sakai.
Now, we've got so many different names going here, it get a little confusing. For the sake of our audience, we've been talking about Scythians and now Sakas. Can you clear up the difference?
Well,
what are we talking about?
There is no difference in the racial makeup of the two names. Both are Gimmerai or Israelites. And I might add that while most migrated west, there was a segment that went east as far as India and China, a small remnant even going into Japan. Now, those going into India are part of the great so-called Aryan invasion of history of India.
And where did they go from there? We've got Scythians in South Russia, and where do they go?
The Scythians in Russia, now they migrated to an area that historians call Scythia around the 4th century B.C., Now, the same historians, also mainly the Greeks now, record the Scythians as being pushed out of the land later by a people called Sarmatians who came in from the east. Now, these were non-Israelitish people, mixed blood, partly Iranian origin. Now, the reports say the Scythians were driven northwest as far as the Baltic regions and the coasts of Holland and France.
Now, I don't ever remember when studying the story of Europe, the peoples of France and Holland ever being called Scythians.
Well, you wouldn't, because their name was changed again, this time by the Romans, who they're the ones who reported now the activities of the Scythians as they moved out of Scythia.
So what were they called?
Germans.
How about that? You mean all the Scythians became Germans?
No, not exactly. I better first explain where the name German came from. When the Scythians were forced out of Scythia, there was a tendency to confuse the Sarmatians, who now occupied Scythia, with the Scythians that had moved out. So the Romans solved the problem by calling the real Scythians Germanus or Germani, being a Latin word meaning genuine. And thereafter, the Scythians were called Germans, simply meaning genuine Scythians. The nation of Germany we think about today came about many centuries later by a small portion of the greater number, these so-called Germanic-speaking people.
Now, I have to wonder how many modern historians know this.
Well, this is well known by the scholars, but they do not know exactly where the countless thousands of Scythians came from. Now, they only trace them back as far as the Black Sea area in South Russia and around what we call Scythia.
Okay, if the Germans are only a small part of the Scythians, what happened to the rest of them?
Well, they broke up into many divisions. One group formed the Goths, to settle around the shores of the Baltic Sea. Others became the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, Danes, and Vikings, just to name a few.
Now, I know people are, we've still got all these names that we're floating around here that are not the kind of names we normally talk about when we're here in America, but we left the Cimmerians being pushed out of Lydia, but didn't follow up with what happened to them. Were they absorbed by the Scythians?
Well, no. What happened was when the Scythians migrated west around the Black Sea above it, they came into collision with these Cimmerians. Now, their kinship, of course, was lost during the passing centuries. Ensuing battles ended with the Cimmerians having to move straightly west, long before the Scythians themselves were pushed out of the area by the Sarmatians.
I remember you said they became a bedrock of the British race, but you didn't say how they got there.
Well, when the Cimmerians were now, they're now called Celts, the Romans kept the records, they moved west into Central Europe and spread in all directions. Actually, about 300 B.C., some of them invaded Italy and sacked Rome. Others migrated back into Asia Minor, where they were called by the Greeks Galatians. We now know that Paul's letters to the Galatians were to his kinsmen Israelites, that is, descendants of the early Galatians, although the modern Bible scholars call them Gentiles. And as I said before, they eventually began to pour into Britain as one group actually settled in Ireland, later moving into Scotland as Scots. So all these people, the British, we call British people today, all came from the Cimmerians, and the upper part came from Scythians. So the two different branches of the Israelites poured into Britain.
Okay, do we have any other corroborating evidence that would prove that the Scots are Israelites?
Well, one interesting point I like to bring out is the Scottish Declaration of Independence. Now, this was drawn up in 1320 A.D. and declares now the Scots as having come from Scythia, and they date their history from the Exodus. They term that the outgoing of the people of Israel from Egypt. Now, this gives a date of 1,200 years after the Exodus, which took place around 1453 B.C. That would give us a date of about 253 B.C., for the beginning of their national identity, that is Scotland. Now, that fits in very close with the historical and archaeological findings.
That's real interesting that the Scottish Declaration declares just who Israel really is, and yet again, that isn't normally given out as historical or in history classes aren't normally telling us that today. I've got an article here, by the way, from the U.S. News and World Report, March 30th, 1987, that I think even you'll find interesting. Ray, ties in so perfectly with what we find in the Scottish Declaration of Independence. It's a picture of Cardinal John O'Connor and Mayor Ed Koch, and the caption for it is "Begorra, it's Mr. Mayor." Here's what it says what it says underneath the picture. They're embracing each other, and it says it was St. Patrick's Day in America, and the Irish dyed the river green in Chicago, tinted the snow emerald in the Massachusetts mountains, and painted the center stripe down Fifth Avenue in shamrock hues so New York's 125,000 marchers wouldn't go astray. For one day, everyone was Irish. Cardinal John O'Connor had a warm embrace for Mayor Ed Koch, who explained his presence at the head of the grand parade thusly, quote, "It's part of my roots. The 10 lost tribes of Israel, we believe, ended up in Ireland." End quote. Now, Mr. Ed Koch, I believe, is probably a Khazar Jew. Probably doesn't have any lineage back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob himself. And, of course, we know it wasn't only the 10 tribes, but the biggest majority of all 12 tribes, who not only ended up in Scotland, but Ireland as well.
Well, I hadn't seen the article. I'll tell you, he told the truth. Some of them did end up in Ireland and then Scotland.
Scotland, in that order.
Another writer, Harry Golden, also a Jewish writer, he made reference to the Israelites coming into Britain and said that he put it this way, I believe, now Methodists and Baptists, Presbyterian, after all, they're all our cousins. We're all interrelated of the tribe. But I like this little point he added. But we knew it all the time. Why didn't they tell us years ago?
Huh,
this was in a Jewish newspaper I read.
Interesting. It's also interesting, there's not only from the Jews themselves, but we go back in our own history here in America, and we can find both here in America and in England, many of our forefathers understood that we were Israel. I remember one quote that first time I heard it really struck out at me, and that was a quote by Thomas Jefferson. On the death of George Washington, he stated that a great man in Israel has died this day, referring to President George Washington. Let me take a moment here at this point to allow you to give your address again and mention the name of your book and the price of it, and because I'm sure there are going to be people who are going to be interested in getting that book.
Okay, it's called The Missing Links, Discovered in Assyrian Tablets, $11 postpaid, from Artisan Sales, P.O. Box 1497, Thousand Oaks, California, 91358. May I add something about Ireland? You mentioned that a minute ago.
Go ahead.
Interesting note, the Catholic Church, of course, claims the saints in Ireland as all being Roman Catholic, whereas, in fact, for about 700 years, they were not Roman Catholic. They were Catholic in the sense of being universal, and they did not recognize Rome as their leader or mother church. They actually, their doctrine was quite different. That was called the Culdee, or the early Culdee Church of Scotland. It was actually the Culdee Church of England. And it was started, the Culdee in Hebrew means refugees. A church started by Joseph of Arimathea in Glastonbury. That's another story I won't get into.
You've got a book on Glastonbury, do you not?
Yes, I have a book called Traditions of Glastonbury that brings that out. I'm right now making a film to go with a book called Origin of Christianity in Britain. I do have that book published, Origin of Christianity in Britain, written about 50 years ago. And it shows how the early church, St. Columba, even St. Patrick, were not Roman. The 11th century before the Roman monks took over the Columbian monks in Scotland.
Interesting. Before we go to the phones and open the phone lines up, we've traced the Israelites now from their Assyrian captivity on through the name changes on into Britain, to Ireland and Scotland. Can we trace them into America?
Well, yes, I think you can. We notice the lost tribes, so-called lost tribes of Israel. We can find them all over Europe, Western Europe, and the Isles, Scandinavian, Germanic, Lombardic peoples. Now, we know these people, study the history of America. These are the people that moved into this country and, you might say, peopled America in the very beginning. These different people all came to America. I believe America is a regathering of Israel.
Of course, one of the promises given to Abraham was that his seed would be not only become a multitude of people, but would become a great nation, but not only a great nation, but a multitude of nations. And we could certainly see that America and the peoples who peopled this land certainly fulfill those promises given to Abraham's progeny.
The prophecies passed on down, of course, to Joseph. And we know from Joseph came Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, the prophecy was Ephraim to become a company of nations, as you mentioned, but you didn't add this. They were also to have a king, definitely, and a company of nations would be a commonwealth, wouldn't it? That's England today. Now, Manasseh would become a great nation, and interesting state is, I believe it says that their governors shall rise out of the midst of them. So what the Bible prophecy says is they're going to be ruled by their own people, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, a republic. And I believe America is a regathering of all the tribes of Israel.
Well, Mr. Capt, you certainly have supplied us good reason why our pilgrim fathers called themselves the seed of Abraham, God's servants, children of Jacob, and his chosen. There's certainly, again, much historical proof from our forefathers that they understood that they were Israel. Some, the way they spoke, they may not have literally understood it, but they certainly had an understanding in their heart that they somehow had a tie back to Israel. You've certainly given us archaeological evidence that proves that indeed it's a fact that instead of the Jews today being Israel, that indeed it's the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, Kindred, and Celtic people. Why don't we go to the phones, Mr. Capt? We're already less time than I wanted to give to our callers because I know they're going to have lots of questions for you and comments that they want to make. This has been indeed a very interesting program. And somebody's already on the line. I'll give the phone number for those of you after we take this call. Okay, you're on the air. You have a question for Mr. Capp.
Well, I just want to make some comments. When you started telling about the 1980 Jewish almanac, well, the static got real big there.
Oh, it did. How about that? Interesting timing.
I had to cut the gain back some so I could get the rest up. But I didn't get the zip out at Thousand Oaks. And another thing, I suppose you'd be talking and tell them what Lewis Beam had to say and maybe what Paul Hall is going to break open. Pastor Peter indicated that it would be something great, you know, a big revelation, what Paul Hall had to bring to the meeting.
Okay, yeah, we'll maybe talk about that on one of the other coming programs this week. Let me go ahead and let you let Ray give his address again, since you didn't get the whole address from it.
Yeah, I'd like to write and get some books, because this is very interesting when you can trace our ancestry back, you know, archaeologically, and you get the missing links, and they're not telling the people. They don't want us to know.
Okay,
so I'll hang up. This is Ron out in Ohio, and you're coming in loud and clear, except when you get down to the nitty-gritty, and then you get the...
Well, let's see. Well, I'll let him give his address, Ron, and we'll see if they do it to us again when I read it here again.
That's Post Office Box 1497, Thousand Oaks, California, 91358.
91358.
Great. Okay, you got it.
I've got everything else.
All right. Thanks,
Thank
Ron,
you.
For calling.
Good night.
Good to hear from you again. Let me also at this time give Scriptures for America's address in case you want to write them. It's P.O. Box 766. LaPorte, that's L-A, capital P-O-R-T-E, Colorado, 80535, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. Let me read that quote, because it's certainly an important quote, an admission by the Jews that they today are not Israel. There's been a mistaken identity out there, and our preachers today across this land have misidentified who Israel is in the Bible, and I'll guarantee if you misidentify Israel in the Bible, there's a big portion of both the Old and the New Testament that you cannot understand correctly or apply to the right people. So let me read again from the Jewish Almanac. This is the 1980 Jewish Almanac. The first title, the first chapter is titled Identity Crisis. Now, they may be interfering, so listen closely. The subtitle is entitled A Brief History of the Terms for Jew, and the first sentence reads, and I quote, strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew. Let me say it again. Let me read it again. It says, strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew. Now, if they're admitting they're not Israel, then why are our preachers across this land telling us that the Jews are Israel? Well, I'll tell you why. Because many of them have been deceived themselves, and they've been deceived to the point where they've become what's called Zionist Christians, which is a total dichotomy of terms, and they are out promoting that we are to support the land of Israeli, and it's been one big lie. It's kind of the lie of Israel lie, Israeli. They are supporting, they're preaching that we need to support those people because they're Israel, when indeed they're not. They've been supporting the murder of Arab women, men, and children to promote the Zionist concept over in the land of Israel, when indeed those people are not Israel. They admit it themselves. This is just one quote. I'm myself personally in the process of finishing up a book. We're going to be typesetting it following camp, and there'll be quote after quote after quote from the Jews themselves where they admit they are not Israel, and quotes both from the Bible, archaeology, as well as history that prove indeed who is Israel today. Let's go to the phones again. Maybe someone has a call. The number, if you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Mr. Capt, it's area code 406-387-5807. Again, that's 406-387-5807. I'm sure there's some questions out there for Ray at this time. Ray, while we're waiting for a call, is there anything else you'd like to add to...
Well, I might add that the Israelites were not the first ones into Ireland. Even before the Exodus, before 1500 B.C., the tribe of Dan, the tribe of Asher, in fact, the Tuatha Dé, people of God, moved into Ireland.
Okay, let's take this phone call. Okay, you're on the air with Mr. Cap.
Hello, Mr. Cap. How you doing?
Fine.
I don't know if you have information pertaining to this or not. I'm going to ask you anyway. I'm going to order that pyramid, did you say? Is that the name of the...
I have two of the Great Pyramid Decoded for $5, or Study in Pyramidology for $11.
Okay.
It's the most comprehensive book you'll find on the subject. Many things in there that are not in print.
That's excellent. I'll order that. Question. Maybe you can tell me if you have knowledge of this or not. The issue of the word, per se, the origin of the word Jew, it did not come into existence, says Pete, until 1775 in the King James. The 1611 version did not have it. I think it was Judahite. What in the other, per se, Catholic or other versions of the Bible, does it maintain that basic origin as far as that basic time period?
Well,
or did it come into existence earlier in other Bibles?
Second Kings, I'll be your first find the first reference to the word Jew. The word Jew was a meaning Judean, originally a corruption of Judah.
Okay.
And that Jew was a name that historian, for example, Josephus brings that out in some of his writings, but I believe he used the word Judean.
Okay.
Now, one of the tablets of the Assyrian Empire, one of the tablets in the British Museum, talks about Shalmaneser capture and so-and-so, and he mentioned the word Jew. That shook me up a little bit, because that goes back way back. And I went to the British Museum and checked out the word itself, and the word is actually Judean. Even the British Museum translated that Jew, which they shouldn't have done. It's Judean, because the word Jew could mean an Israelite or a non-Israelite.
Right. Well, I think it was intended to cause confusion, which it has, and I'm just trying to ascertain... to the best of my ability, and from what I've heard Pete mention, the original who created that word, and I guess if we have to think of someone who had the best intention of it, it would be the people who call themselves Jews.
Well, that's true.
I'm just trying to find origins other than with the King James, more Catholic-oriented Bibles, I guess, that some people are questioning, or when I brought this up to them, they said, oh, it was older than that. Well, I'm just trying to find proof for that.
Well, I don't think it was intentional. I think this came about Hyrcanus in 285 B.C. when he forced the Edomites to become Jews by religion, that is, accept Judaism at the time, be circumcised, and become full-fledged citizens. And from that time forward, now they're called Jews.
Would it be correct to say, when you say Judaism is no more or... pretty parallel to Babylonian Talmudism?
Well, I'm an archaeologist, not a theologian.
Right.
But I'll go along with you. The Talmud, I don't believe in Judaic Christianity, if that's what you're getting at.
Well, I don't either.
Okay.
Right, okay.
Because out of Judah, out of Babylon, did not come our Christianity.
Right.
Christ himself condemned the... Pharisees and Sadducees for reading out of the tradition of the elders, and they should go back to the teachings of the laws of Moses.
Right.
So I'll tell you, the Jewish people today, I talk to a lot of them, they agree that their Talmud is a Babylonian Talmud. They do not use the Mosaic Talmud.
Yeah, I speak to one here myself in town. I take him to task numerous times, and I catch him in things, and he does agree to that the Talmud is what the, quote, Jews of today follow. So it's just a matter of tying them down to things. But I appreciate this information on the pyramid. And
I have a book that goes into more about the Edomians. It's called, one of the books here called Petra. Petra will give you the archaeological evidence and historical evidence of how Edomites became Jews.
Okay. And you did say there was, getting back to the pyramid thing, there was nothing really... in your mind, crucial about the crystals and such that were...
No, nothing whatsoever. There's a lot of esoteric and metaphysical material written around the pyramid, and they keep it a mystery all the time.
Okay.
My book will, I hope, dispel a lot of the mystery of the Great Pyramid.
Right, I just, from a logical standpoint, thought it may have had something to do with storing energy, per se, with the specific shape of that structure...
Well, I don't buy that except this. Every shape has energy. Now, if they were going to use an energy, it's so slight they can't even measure it.
Right.
They should have used a dodecahedron, not a pyramid. A dodecahedron would have more energy along the lines they're trying to tell us.
Gotcha.
But you can't You can't light street lights with it or anything. There's not that much energy. It's so minute, it has to be measured by equipment, special equipment.
I see. Well, God bless you guys, and keep up the good work.
Where are you calling from?
Nolens.
Nolens.
New Orleans.
Okay. New Orleans. Well, glad to hear from you, even if it's from New Orleans.
Hey, that's right. Sorry we can't be up there, but hopefully we'll try to catch you in Virginia.
Great.
West Virginia.
Great.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you there.
Good. Looking forward to seeing you, too.
Great. Thank you. Okay, the number is 406-387-5807 if you have a question for Mr. Kapp. There's the phone ringing. Okay, you're on the air with Pastor Ted Weiland and Raymond Kapp.
Yes, good evening. Okay,
good
this
evening.
Is New Jersey calling.
Okay.
All right, question on the pyramid. You stated that according to measurements, you had found historical times and moments. Now, I have read over 40 years ago that a group of scientists, archaeologists from different countries, have studied the pyramids, and they claim the same thing. And that they also stated, well, they call it a modern-day or an old-day calendar, and they stated that it ended at the year 2000. Would you know anything about this?
Several writers, I believe Davidson might have been one of them, that tried to end the date around 2000, very conveniently working periods of 1,000 each. They had to start with 4,000 years for Adam. But now we know through historical research that Adam goes back, according to Bible chronology, 5,450 or something like that, because the texts have been corrupted. 100 years have been taken out of all the dates of the patriarchs, from Adam to Noah, and Noah, a little less than that, Noah to Abraham. So the Septuagint Bible gives the longer dates. The Dead Sea Scrolls give the longer dates. So those dates show that the Bible is corrupted. The flood is 1,000 years earlier than we think. So if you start with 5407, that'd be a 5407. You don't have those thousands coming out exactly to 2,000.
This is just what they stated.
Well, they also I have books that said they're going to end in 1979, 1953, 1914. Now, there are some dates in the pyramid, but through hindsight, we can show they fit the ages of the Bible. For instance, in 1453 B.C., the passage changes, and that's the giving of law on Mount Sinai, and that age lasted 1,485 inches. That's exactly how, years rather, and that's exactly how many inches it is to reach the Grand Gallery, which is AD 33, the crucifixion of Christ. So we find biblical ages there through hindsight, but many writers have been speculating for over the years, and time shows they've all been wrong.
Okay, I've got one other question. It's been bugging me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said these pyramids were built by Egyptian laborers.
Yes.
And if people say that designers or something came from Arabia.
The supervisors or foremen came from Arabia. These were biblical characters.
Now,
and by the way, they built several practice pyramids before they built the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is with accumulation of the skills developed over a series of years. And they finally had a skillful enough to build a Great Pyramid, and then the builders left. And the
I read a book that these people that had this knowledge to do things like this, I don't know, you might laugh at me or something, came from the continent Atlantis. When it first started to sink, all these people took off in different directions, and they all went to the Middle East, and everything settled here and there, and brought with them all this knowledge that could, you know, move stones and things like that and so forth. Would you know anything about this?
I don't think about it. You can't find any evidence. You can't talk about it. It's purely speculation.
Atlantis purely speculation.
Yes. There's no evidence whatsoever been found.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Now, I was just curious. The book was by Casey. Ever hear of him, Dr. Casey?
Yes. He's a Rosicrucian.
Yeah, he was a preaching prophet.
It's very. Edgar Casey, that's a whole different subject I don't want to go into. This man was a gifted man of God to heal illnesses. And he was manipulated into a seance under induced sleep. He was told, supposedly said these things. Now, he was under about 5 minutes, and the man who put him under was a furniture dealer who believed in all this material, and when he came out, he told Gacy, you said so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. You confirmed reincarnation. You confirmed this. Gacy said, wait a minute. I haven't been out that long. Now, this man was a teacher of that, been teaching it for years, and under a sleep condition, I believe he induced that into Casey's mind. I don't think Casey ever meant to say that.
Yeah, you would call us all spiritualism then.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Okay,
all right, hey, all right. Thank you, Ray Tapp. I'm going to send away for your books.
Good to hear from you.
All right, God bless.
Okay.
Bye.
I might, I just got to thinking here, I might mention that for those of you who might have joined us at the top of the hour, you might wonder how we jumped from cuneiform tablets to the pyramid. Well, in the first half an hour before the top of the hour, we had Mr. Kaff elaborate on pyramidology and the book that he has on that subject. Ray, why don't you go ahead and mention that book, the title of it, and give your address one more time.
Study in Pyramidology, $11 postpaid, or The Great Pyramid Decoded, $5 postpaid. One's an outline, the other's a full book on it.
Okay, we'll get your address just a little later. Let's take this phone call. Okay, you're on the air with archaeologist Raymond Kapp.
Yes. I have read that the blocks from the pyramid were actually cast and not carved out of actual blocks. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, it absolutely was not cast. We find the sandstone, limestone, has little shells in there, and they couldn't have put all those little shells in the same order in a casting. And why would they, if it were cast, they would have to have 144,000 different shapes and sizes to fit the ones that are there. No, it doesn't cast at all. The joints are 1/50th of an inch, vary from a straight line 1/100th of an inch, and they fill it with fine, smooth cement. It's perfect job, but it took years of skill developing people to do that kind of work.
Then the very narrow spaces between the blocks were actually filled with a cement.
Let me back off of that. I should make that a little clearer. The casing stones had that. The core and masonry, no, were rough, uneven spaces in between everything else. They're all different shapes and sizes.
Casting was.
I can't imagine any scholar coming up with that kind of theory.
Oh, okay. Then I've always heard that the fittings of the stone were so fine that you could slip a piece of paper.
That is right. That's the casing stones only. 144,000 that encase the outside of the pyramid.
Okay, but the inner stones were a much coarser.
Much coarser, just slapped together. But they're all different. I'll say this: each layer, of course, was fairly uniform in thickness, but all the courses varied from one from another. But the stones themselves were just jammed together.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Where are you calling from?
White Oaks, New Mexico.
New Mexico, okay. Great. Great to have you on the air tonight. Any other questions? Okay, we might be able to sneak in one. I'm looking over here at Steve. 320. Okay, if somebody has a quick question, you're okay. All right, you're on the air.
Hello.
Excuse me? You're on the air.
I'm on the air.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Need a quick question.
Yeah,
Run out of time.
I was wondering about the word Jew. There's a book I happened to see in a local college library called The Jewish Yearbook. Really thick book. Really thick. Like 4 inches thick.
Okay.
It mentions that when the Israeli state was founded, a lot of Jews there wanted to call it Judah. Did you know that?
I was not aware of that. Of course, that doesn't surprise me if they would, because they're falsely claiming to be Israel or Judah. They specifically want to be Judah because Judah was given the scepter.
It's an interesting thing. A lot of people don't know that. If they knew that, a lot of them wanted to call it Judah, it might make them think a little bit in relation to it.
Okay, we're about out of time here. I hate to cut you off so quickly, but let me see if Ray has something he wants to comment on that, and then we're going to have to wrap this down.
I really had no comment on that. I might add that my book has other links beside archaeology. It has links of language showing the early Welsh or British language is almost identical with Hebrew. It also talks about heraldry. Some of the tribal heraldry is found in the Anglo-Saxon peoples. The tribes of Judah originated.
Okay. All right, where are you calling from?
Northern Illinois. Might I ask a quick question about the lost manuscript of the Book of Acts?
I wish we could, but we just don't have time. We're
about out of it. I'll send you a catalog on if you write for a book.
Okay. Thank you. Ray, we're going to have to be real quick here. Give your address one more time.
Okay. It's Box 1497, Thousand Oaks, California, 91358. And I'll send a complete list of my publications, about 45 of them, dealing with the pyramid, Stonehenge, Jacob's Pillar, stars, quite a few subjects.
Ray, it's been a great program. Just pleased to have you on the program. This is my first time hosting it, so it's been an extra pleasure for me to have you as my first guest.
My pleasure, too.
Taking Pete's place. This is Evangelist Ted Weiland. I am in place of Pete Peters tonight, taking the chair of hosting. And we are broadcasting from Kalispell, Montana, as Scriptures for America's 9th Annual Family Bible Camp. Wish you were here, but we'll be here tomorrow night and the nights to come. We are pleased to be here, Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535, for those of you who would like to write. Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yahweh make His face shine on you and be gracious to you. Yahweh lift up His countenance on you and give you peace.
You have been listening to Scriptures for America with Pastor Pete Peters. Should you wish to write Pastor Peters, the mailing address is Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. Again, the mailing address is Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. Since Scriptures for America is heard on numerous radio stations throughout the United States, please, when writing, let us know the call letter.